Okay, so I guess we can begin. So the first thing I want to do today is set in stone the date of the first exam. So I told you earlier this week that Friday, a week from today, would be sort of an optimal date. Any objections to that? Okay, so we will have our first exam a week from today. It'll be in class. Oops. It will be in class, and what I'll do today, although I said it was a quick review, it may very well take half the lecture because I want to touch on all the points that we've covered since the beginning of the semester. That's a good thing to do the weekend before the exam, and so I'll sort of run through what we've covered so far, and then what I'm going to do today and Monday is I'm going to talk about the next topic in the course, which is subspaces. So we'll do that. Now, I will probably also talk about subspaces on Monday, but Monday will also be a good opportunity. Hopefully, homework sets 4 and 5 are due on Monday. If you have any issues with those problem sets, you should raise them. Well, you can raise them now if you have any questions, but certainly by Monday would be a best time to get homework problems straightened down, any difficulties there. Then Wednesday of next week, we'll do a full review. I'll walk you through a sample exam and show you, effectively that the exams, even though they can be long, particularly when there's a lot of row reduction, that's sort of a tedious calculation. I'll try to show you by explicitly working through exam sort of the most efficient way to get through one of the exams. And in fact, what you'll find if you follow the practice exam and know the material, that my exams were just for doing the calculations alone, you should be able to do that in a half hour. And so you have an extra 20 minutes to actually think about things a little bit. But what I typically do though is I give you a practice exam, and the exam I give is based on the practice exam rather than homework or other things. So if you understand how to do the practice exam, those questions about what to do on a given problem, they should have already been resolved for you, and you just have to carry it out. Okay, so we'll talk more about the format of the exam next Wednesday. Let me first of all, pause and make sure any outstanding questions. Okay, so what I want to talk about first then is the things we've covered so far. We started off the course with, you enter the course with a variety of definitions of what a vector is. It's a quantity with magnitude and direction, it's a directed line segment, etc. But what we specialize to immediately in the beginning of the course is thinking of vectors as ordered lists of numbers, because that's, first of all, very concrete, and second of all, it's the essence of all the calculations we do in the course. So we introduce vectors and how to manipulate them. We had vector addition. Of course, you've known how to add vectors ever since you took Calculus 1, I would expect. However, I want you to also think of them a little bit more abstractly as well. Think of what the operation does. It takes pairs of vectors and it produces a new vector. And similarly, scalar multiplication is an operation that's easy to perform, but also think about it abstractly. You take a number and a vector and you get a vector out of it. And then we had linear combinations of vectors, which basically means combining these two operations to create more vectors. So typically, you're scalar multiplying vectors and you're adding them together to produce new vectors. In fact, this is the most general construction that we use in this course, and we use it over and over and over again to create linear combinations. We also have the dot product, which is useful for a couple of reasons. First of all, it gives us geometric information about these ordered lists of numbers. Using a dot product of vectors, we can detect not only the length of the vector, whether it's a 10-dimensional vector or a 2-dimensional vector, and we can also calculate the angle between two vectors using the dot product. But you could think of it as an operation that takes a pair of vectors and just kicks out a number. All right, so that was the basic apparatus that we're dealing with the exception of matrices that come in just a second. The first thing I did with this material is I talked a bit about the geometry of vector spaces, but it's kind of extravagant to call it geometry because it's so simple. The geometric objects we consider in this course are not things like tetrahedral or spheres or toruses or other fancy geometric objects. Rather, they're either points, lines, planes, or generalizations of those objects. They're just hyperplanes. And they're all constructed the same way. You get a hyperplane is going to be a set of vectors where you start off at a point, and then you take a linear combination of a given list of vectors, and you let those coefficients vary over the entire real line. And then the set of vectors is going to be an infinite set of vectors because you have an infinite number of choices for each of these parameters, t1 through tk. You get a large set of vectors, and in fact, it's either going to be a point, that's if you don't have these terms, you get a line if you have just one vector from which you can depart from v0, and more generally, you have higher dimensional hyperplanes, but all based on this simple construction that itself is built from vector addition and scalar multiplication. Okay, and then one of the first utilities of this simple geometry was the fact that if you have a system of equations, or in fact, if you just have a single equation in m variables, that you can associate with this equation a certain hyperplane. And in fact, what it is, it's a hyperplane in the space of variables. You can use this equation to, say, solve for xm in terms of the other variables. And so x1 and xm, I'm thinking here as free variables in the solution to this equation. And what you see is that as soon as I solve for xm and use that to replace the m component, you're able to expand an arbitrary vector that satisfies the equations in terms of a constant vector and some parameters times other constant vectors. It's exactly of this form. So solution sets of a single linear equation is always a hyperplane of dimension one less than the space of variables. Here, count your variables, your free variables. You have m minus one of them, but each of these vectors is going to be an m-dimensional vector. And so effectively, you have a m minus one dimensional solution set embedded inside an m-dimensional space of variables for this equation. All right, and then when you have more equations, geometrically, that just corresponds to intersecting hyperplanes. But the intersections of hyperplanes are also hyperplanes, though they'll still be sets of that form, even when they're intersections of larger hyperplanes. Okay, and so the next gadget we introduced in the course were matrices. I introduced them by first talking a little bit about linear systems, as on the last slide, and then the way we solve these linear systems. Our technique was essentially to manipulate the equations until we got the equations of the solution. However, that was not very efficient, so we developed another method that did exactly the same thing. We would take the equations, we would take the data, the coefficients and the numbers on the right-hand side, and we would arrange those into a matrix. And then we can manipulate these equations by instead working with this simpler object, just a matrix. And the idea, well, this is how matrices came into the game. I guess I should explain a little bit more about matrices before I describe what we do with augmented matrices. So at this stage of the course, I just wanted to introduce this notion of a matrix as basically a rectangular arrangement of numbers with a certain fixed number of rows and a fixed number of columns. And we learned how we can multiply these guys together. A matrix product, A times B, first of all, you have to remember that it's only defined when the number of columns of the first factor equals the number of rows of the second factor. That's because the individual entries of the product are determined by a dot product. And to take a dot product of two vectors, they have to have the same dimension. So that restriction that the number of columns of A is equal to the number of rows of B, that's just so that these dot products are defined. But if that's true, the dot product will be defined and you'll be able to calculate all the entries of a product of two matrices. And then besides the being able to multiply matrices together, we could also add individual matrices together, and we can scale or multiply them as well. But that works essentially the same way as it did for vectors. When you add vectors, they have to have the same dimension. And when you add matrices, they have to be the same number of rows and the same number of columns. But the operation is the same. You just add similar components of both vectors to get the sum of two matrices, and you scalar multiply. You multiply every entry of a matrix by a particular number to carry out scalar multiplication of matrices. And then the last basic matrix operation was the transpose, and that's simply where you take a matrix and you convert its rows that were written horizontally. You write down another matrix where the rows of the first matrix have been converted into columns. All right, so now we get to solving linear systems. So the idea was that there are things we can do to equations that don't change the solution set. So on a formal level, the way we're trying to solve linear equations is not by focusing on variables, but rather focusing on entire sets of equations until we get the equations of the solution. So there were things we could do to equations, like interchanging the order equations, multiplying equations by number, replacing an equation by its sum with another equation. Those elementary operations wouldn't change the solution set, but we found that there was a much simpler way of implementing them that could be very rapid. And that was by, instead of working directly on the equations, going back and working instead on the equivalent object, these augmented matrices. And in that guise, the things we could do to equations became operations we could perform directly on the augmented matrices. They were called row operations because each row of the augmented matrix corresponds to an equation. So when you do something on the equation side, there's going to be an equivalent operation that you can do on the augmented matrix side. And that's what we focused on. So we had three different things we could do to an augmented matrix that would replicate actions on a set of equations that did not change the solution. All right, so we had the plan is to systematically convert a given linear system into the equations of the solution, but the way we do it is we work with the augmented matrix rather than the equations themselves. We use three operations to systematically transform the augmented matrix you start off with to the augmented matrix of the solution. And there's maybe three basic steps to that. First of all, you need to reach row echelon form. So that simply means that the pivots are really a crucial concept. It's how we actually identify the special forms of the augmented matrix. So the pivots are always the first non-zero entries in a row. And what we try to do as we solve a linear system is our first task is to get the augmented matrix in row echelon form. So when you started off with a matrix, you might not have zeros below this pivot in the first column. But then you can use operations like this to clear out the entries below. And you systematically work your way from the upper left of the matrix down to the lower right, clearing out entries below pivots and also moving the pivots off to the right as you descend through the matrix. All right, so that's the first stage. And in fact, once you reach this stage, the pivots don't move any further. Well, there's more row reduction to do before we reach reduced row echelon form, which is something like this, but the positions of the pivots don't change. To get it this matrix in this form, what you have to do is use row operations like scalar multiplication to change whatever number is there to make it one. So if this were three, I would divide this row by three so that I can get a one for its pivot. And you do that for all your rows. And then in addition, you try to clear out this passing the row echelon form. What you're doing here is you're clearing out entries below the pivots. In the passing to reduce row echelon form, besides making your pivots equal to one, you also want to clear out the entries above pivots. And that's again going to be using this third elementary row operation for the most part. All right, so the idea for solving a linear system is to convert, well, I guess it's on the next slide. You convert your system of equations, you represent it as an augmented matrix. Then you row reduce to row echelon form. And then your strategy changes. In this part of the row reduction, you work from the upper left to the lower right. Then to get to reduce row echelon form, you start in that bottom right corner and you clear out entries in the low above pivots in the lower rows, and you work your way up to the upper left. But once you've done that, you reach a unique matrix that's in reduced row echelon form. And that's going to be the augmented matrix that corresponds to the solution of your linear system. So once you've reached this, the next stage is actually to write down the solution. So you convert back to equations. And in doing so, you make a distinction between two kinds of variables. Fixed variables. These are going to correspond to columns of the reduced row echelon form, but in fact, already identifiable when you reach row echelon form, because, let's go back to the previous slide, once you reach row echelon form, the position of the pivots is not changing, and so the columns they live in are not changing any further either. So already at this stage, you can count the number of free variables in your solution. You just look for the columns without pivots when you're in row echelon form. Doesn't give you the solution, but it tells you the dimension of the solution. To get the solution itself, you have to proceed further to reduce row echelon form, use the position of the pivots to identify which variables you should regard as fixed and which variables you should regard as free. Then at this stage, you take the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form, and you go ahead and write down the corresponding equations. But what you use those equations for is to express the fixed variables in terms of free variables. In any given row of that augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form, it only has one pivot. And the other non-zero entries we have are going to be attached to free variables. So we just simply move the free variables to the other side of the equation, and then we have the fixed variables expressed in terms of the free variables. So once we convert back to equations, we move the free variables, say, over to the right-hand side of the equation, and then you write down a typical solution vector, substituting where you can for the fixed variables. They'll be expressed now in terms of free variables, and you end up with a solution vector that now depends only on the free parameters. Now, the last step of this is to expand the solution vector in terms of the free parameters, and then you'll get that hyperplane that corresponds to the solution. Yeah. Yeah. So let's start with a matrix that's in, let's write this one, 0, 1, 0, 2, 1, 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 2, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. That's, okay, so it's only, Well, we can put something non-trivial. No, I can't. I've used up all the pivots. Okay, so let's do this one. Okay, so here we have a pivot, and here we have a pivot. So that corresponds to x2 and x3. So those are going to be fixed variables, right? Because they correspond to columns that have pivots. That leaves x1 and x4 as free variables, because in this augmented matrix in row echelon form, there are no pivots in the first and last column of the coefficient side of the augmented matrix. All right, so let's write down the equations. x2 plus 2 times x4 has to equal 1. Second row says that x3 minus x4 has to equal 2. And the last row says 0 is equal to 0, so it's kind of a trivial equation. It doesn't put any restrictions at all on my variables. But zeros occur during the row reduction process if you have equations that have a relation amongst themselves. All right, so I've got the equations, and I'm like, no, let's express the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. So the fixed variables were x2 and x3. So x2 is going to equal 1 minus 2x4, and x3 from the second equation is equal to 2 plus x4. Remember to flip the signs when you move the variables to the opposite side. And then you write down a typical solution vector. What you'll do is, for the fixed variables, you'll substitute the right-hand side of these two equations. But for the free variables, you don't make any substitution. So x1, first column has no pivot, so it's free. I don't change it. x2 can be expressed in terms of x4, so I write it as 1 minus 2x4. x3 can be expressed in terms of x4, 2 plus x4, and x4 itself is free. All right, so there's the functional form of any solution vector. It depends on the free parameters x1 and x4. The last step is to expand that solution vector in terms of the free variables. So we have terms that don't involve free variables, nothing in the first slot, 1 in the second slot, 2 in the third slot, and 0 in the fourth slot. Then we have x1 terms, and in fact, it only occurs in this first slot, so x1, 0, 0, 0, and the x4 does not appear in the first slot, with coefficient minus 2 in the second slot, coefficient 1 in the third, and coefficient 1, so that's x4. Okay, and so there you, now we have a solution vector expressed as a point on a hyperplane. Here's your starting point. Here are the two directions from which you can leave the starting point. And this free parameter is just a number that could you can vary over the entire real line to generate a two-dimensional plane of solutions. Okay, I'm sorry if you can't see that from there. Okay, so okay, yeah, other questions? Oh, yeah, there's one caveat to this procedure. Sometimes you have equations that don't have any solution. The way you identify those situations is when you have an augmented matrix where you have a non-zero entry in the last column and zeros everywhere else. Let me explain that caveat. So, so if you have a matrix like this, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, let's put some numbers here, 2, 1, 1, I can look at this matrix and I know immediately there's no solution. How am I seeing that? I'm looking at this last row And if I write down the equation that corresponds to this last row, it's 0 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3 is equal to 1. Well, simplify the right-hand side or left-hand side, and you'll get 0 is equal to 1, and that's a contradiction. It's a mathematical contradiction. And so this augmented matrix implies an equation that has no solution. And so since this augmented matrix has the same solution as the original system of equations, the fact that you can't get you can't find any solution to the last equation means that your original set of equations had no solution either. So this is how you proceed if you have a solution. If you don't have a solution, what will happen is as you row reduce the matrix, you end up with, it could be any number here, it could be 105. Anytime you have a non-zero number in this last column and zeros everywhere else, you're going to end up with an equation that says zero is equal to a non-zero number, and you'll have a contradiction. So, yeah, so this caveat at the end is just so, if you have a contradiction in your equations, how do you recognize this? As soon as you spot a row like this, even if you only have started row reduction, you can stop, because further row reduction is not going to get rid of this problematic equation. Okay? All right. So that's how we solve linear systems. And then the last topic we covered were inverses of square matrices. Remember, it's just a matrix that when you a matrix has an inverse, if you can find another matrix for which when you multiply the two matrices together, you get the identity matrix. And the way we developed that, sorry, it's going right over the crack in the blackboard. The way we found a way of calculating the inverse of a matrix is we use this auxiliary idea, the notion of elementary matrices. What that did, it allowed us to implement elementary row operations using matrix multiplication. That was important to us because if we can row reduce a matrix to the identity matrix, then we would have a sequence of matrices that we can multiply the original matrix and produce the identity matrix. So that sequence of matrices, that product is the inverse. So that's how we discovered how to calculate the inverse. It's how to figure out what sequence of row operations would take A to the identity matrix. And then by forming the corresponding matrices, we can multiply A by a product of matrices and produce the identity matrix. And then finally, we develop a way that we didn't have to identify the individual elementary matrices in this process. All we had to do was take this matrix, row reduce it to reducer echelon form, and whatever occurred in this last factor during that process, that would be the inverse of A. So more precisely, to calculate the inverse of a matrix, you would join to it the identity matrix of the same size, and then you row reduce this double matrix to its reducer echelon form. Now, when you reach the reducer echelon form, you look at it. If on the right-hand side, A has been transformed into the identity matrix, then you know that the left-hand side of that, let me introduce some notation here so I'm not pointing at two different matrices. So let's call this reducer echelon form of this matrix, let's call it A double prime adjoined with I double prime, where A double prime is whatever happened, well, in fact, what has to happen is that if the reducer echelon form of this matrix has the identity matrix on the left-hand side, then this guy is going to be A the minus first. On the other hand, if this whatever happens to the right-hand side is not equal to the identity matrix, then that means there's no inverse. So the calculation of a matrix inverse is straightforward. All you have to do is take a given matrix and row reduce it to reduce your echelon form, and then grab the right-hand factor. The thing you have to worry about, though, is that this guy doesn't necessarily always reduce to the identity matrix. And if it doesn't, the reducial echelon form of this matrix does not have the identity matrix on the left-hand side. That simply means that the matrix does not have an inverse. Okay, so it's a straightforward calculation once you know how to carry out row reduction. And you get a decisive answer as well. Okay. So I think that's, we have, unfortunately, this is maybe not showing up completely on screen. Maybe it will. Okay. The last topic of Monday's lecture was this fundamental theorem of matrix inverses. It's fundamental in the same sense that the fundamental theorem of calculus is really important to calculus. It tells you that antiderivatives are the opposite of derivatives, or integrals are the inverse process of taking derivatives. It connects two seemingly very different things. The fundamental theorem of algebra, it's a statement that you can solve algebraic equations by factorizing the polynomial on one side of it. And so you relate polynomials to solution sets of equations, or how they factor is related to their solution set. Here we have a fundamental theorem of linear algebra called fundamental theorem of matrix inverses, and it relates a bunch of seemingly diverse ideas. The existence of an inverse, the ability to find a unique solution to a corresponding linear system, the fact that if you have a particular linear system where you have the zero vector on the right, that you're only allowed one solution if the matrix has an inverse. Also, you know that the reducial echelon form of a matrix has to be equal to the identity matrix. That's sort of clear from the calculation I just erased. How we calculate the inverse of a matrix is we row reduce A adjoined with I to row echelon form, and if A reduces to I, whatever happened to the right-hand factor was the inverse. And then finally, I guess the A can be factorized as a product of elementary matrices. Is another consequence of A having an inverse. But see, we have a series of five statements that maybe these two are closely related, but the other four statements are pretty disparate in what they're saying. Yet, if any one of these is true, the other is true. So if I know that I only have one solution of such an equation, then I already know that the matrix has an inverse. I don't have to calculate it well, unless I need it explicitly. This kind of thinking, where we begin to relate calculations that we've done in separate contexts, this is going to be where we go next in this course. If we'll start tying things together a lot more closely, yet what we'll be able to do is take consequence of one statement and infer from that another property of the matrix. Okay, so good. So that's my real quick review that summarizes what we've covered since the start of the semester, and that will be the material that will be on the exam. So let me pause here. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to make a little bit of headway on subspaces today. I have about 15 minutes left, so I won't get too far on this, but we'll make more progress on Monday. Let me just remind you that we have a set of vectors in Rn. Linear combinations are just new vectors you can create by combining the operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition. All right, so I've talked about hyperplanes since the beginning of the course. I'm going to focus now on a special case of hyperplanes. So we'll say that a Well, actually, I'll introduce it differently. A span of a set of vectors is going to be the set of every vector you can reach in the entire space by taking linear combinations of these guys. Now, if you only have one direction, then the only place you can go from this guy by taking scalar multiplications of it and adding it to itself are points along the same line. And so if you have a single vector, a span of a single vector is just going to be a line. But it actually has not quite a hyperplane. So this should be the form. So what I've written down here is all by varying these coefficients, I'm effectively constructing a set that contains all possible linear combinations of a given list of vectors. It's not quite a hyperplane because it's missing this initial term. And in fact, that's the crucial point that makes a span of a set of vectors. It is an example of a hyperplane. All I have to do is choose P0 to equal the zero vector, and then this construction just replicates this. But if P0 is not equal to zero, then effectively it sort of offsets this hyperplane. It gets sort of displaced from the origin. So if you had a hyperplane that passed through the origin, which notice that this set, by choosing a number C1 through CK equal to zero, you would have the linear combination where every vector is multiplied by zero, which is going to be the zero vector. So this span always contains the zero vector. But a more general hyperplane doesn't necessarily contain the zero vector. Here's a way to think about it. Let me just work with lines. Here's a general line in the plane, but it's not going to be a span of vectors because it doesn't contain the origin. But you can draw a bunch of parallel lines, none of which actually contain the origin, until you reach the line that passes through the origin. This guy is going to be a span of the vectors, but these other vectors that essentially are lines heading in the same direction, they're just displaced a little bit from the origin. Those are not going to be spans of vectors. What we'll see here is that my comment from early on, when I said that these hyperplanes are little vector spaces sitting inside larger vector spaces, that's not quite right. They look like little vector spaces sitting inside of larger vector spaces, but they fail to be vector spaces because you cannot perform operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition on them consistently. And so this whole point of the next topic, which is subspaces, is to specialize to hyperplanes without this offset here. And if we get rid of that guy, then in fact, these hyperplanes are going to act exactly like vector spaces. We can scalar multiply vectors and stay inside the same hyperplane. We will be able to add vectors inside the hyperplane and they'll still live inside the hyperplane. So what these guys, the span of a set of vectors, what it actually represents is the set of vectors that looks like another vector space, but in fact also admits the action of scalar multiplication and vector addition. So that's the purpose of the definition of the subspace that I'm about to give, but it takes a little development to get to that. The idea in the end is going to be we want to look at special subsets of vectors inside Rn that look like hyperplanes, but in addition, they pass through the origin. So you don't have this offset there. What that will allow us to do is scalar multiply vectors and stay inside the set, or add vectors and we'll still stay inside the set. All right, so let me make this hopefully a little bit clearer by making it a little bit more formal. So let's see. See if I can move this. There we go. All right, so first of all, by an operation on a set, I just mean some procedure or some function that takes elements of the set and produces something else. But our focus here is going to be on operations that are closed. So what I mean by that is you take an element of your set, you do something to it, but you don't go to a new space. You stay inside the same space you started off with, or the same set you started off in. So we've seen this before. The scalar multiplication, it takes a vector inside Rn. Well, it also uses a number, but the result of multiplying a vector, scalar multiplying a vector by lambda, is to produce a new vector. So anytime you have a vector and a number, you can create a new vector that lives in the same vector space as the original vector space. So Rn is said to be closed under scalar multiplication. You do a scalar multiplication, you don't leave Rn. And similarly, when you have two vectors that start off in the n-dimensional vector space, you can add them, but that result of adding those vectors does not take you outside the space. All right, so let's formalize this. We'll say that a subset of our vector space of n-dimensional vectors is closed under scalar multiplication if, whenever you scalar multiply a vector inside the set, you don't leave the set. And it will say a subset of Rn is closed under vector addition if, after you add two vectors that start in the set, you're still inside the same set. Now, that looks really natural, and you might think that, well, there must be lots of subspaces, but in fact, those two properties are actually kind of hard to maintain. Let me give you, here's the definition of subspace. A subspace of Rn is a set that's closed under both those operations, the fundamental operations of linear algebra, scalar multiplication and vector addition. You can think of subspaces as being little vector spaces sitting inside larger vector spaces. So subspaces is sort of like subsets. A subset is a smaller set sitting inside a larger set. Well, subspaces, more so than hyperplanes, can be thought as legitimate vector spaces sitting inside a larger vector space because we can perform scalar multiplication and vector addition without leaving those sets. Let me give you some examples of things that are might think of are nice subsets of, say, of the plane that happen not to be subspaces. Let's take the circle. All the points on the unit circle are points where the distance from the origin is just one, right? So x squared plus y squared is the dot product of this vector of itself. So it's just saying the length, we're looking for vectors of length one. And it's not closed under scalar multiplication because if I choose a number two and I multiply a vector that does live inside this set, 1 squared plus 0 squared does equal one. So this guy lives inside this set. Here's a number. Let's multiply them together. Well, I get a new vector, but now it no longer satisfies the equation to live inside this unit circle. Sum of the squares of the components here is going to equal 4 rather than 1. All right, so the circle is not closed under scalar multiplication, nor is it closed under vector addition. Here are two points, vectors of unit length. They both live on that circle. When I add them together, I get a new vector, but now its length is going to be the square root of 2 rather than 1. Okay, so you just start writing down random sets, particularly ones that you think that are interesting geometrically, not likely at all that they're actually going to be subspaces. Let me do another example. This set T that I'm creating by taking pairs of integers and using them to form two-dimensional vectors, that is halfway towards a subspace, but not quite. It is closed under vector addition because let's take two vectors in the set. I choose an integer, that will be my first vector, another integer, that will be a second vector. If we add the two vectors together, each component is going to be a sum of integers. And so the result of adding two arbitrary vectors inside this set is a vector whose components are still integers. And so this set T, formed by using integers for the entries, is going to be closed under vector addition, but it's not closed under scalar multiplication, because if I decide to take a vector inside this set and multiply it by a real number like the square root of 2, well, now the new component is no longer an integer. And so it's not closed under scalar multiplication. And so from the point of view of linear algebra, this set is not going to be a subspace. We shouldn't try to think of it as a little vector space sitting inside a larger vector space. What about hyperplanes? Hyperplanes were our favorite geometric object. Now, can they be thought of as subspaces? Well, I've already pointed out that this initial term causes a problem. Well, I'll show you how that works out. If you have a set of vectors H that's actually a hyperplane, if this hyperplane does not contain the zero vector, then when you scalar multiply any vector inside the hyperplane by the number zero, you always get the zero vector. But if zero is not sitting inside that hyperplane, you've left the hyperplane. You're in this situation. Here's a one-dimensional hyperplane on the blackboard. If it doesn't contain the origin, then it can't possibly be a subspace, because scalar multiplying any vector along this line by zero is going to move you to a different subspace effectively, or a different hyperplane. Okay, so the examples I've given so far make it look like subspaces must be really rare. But in fact, the usual sets in linear algebra are in fact almost always subspaces. And even these hyperplanes, you can think of it as a subspace that I've offset. So you can think the basic construction is to get that subspace, and then if the subspace isn't quite what you want, then you fix it up. But typically what we're doing in linear algebra constantly is working with not so much individual vectors anymore. Our principal objects that we're going to study henceforth, it's going to be subspaces. And they're going to be effectively things that we can legitimately regard as actual vector spaces, because we can perform scalar multiplication and vector addition without leaving them. So these subspaces are always going to be vector spaces, literal vector spaces inside larger vector spaces. While hyperplanes, you have this problem that if it doesn't contain zero, well, then you're not going to be closed under scalar multiplication. Okay, well, maybe that's good enough for today. What I'm going to do on Monday is I'm going to give you more examples of subspaces, and I'll show you how they arise naturally inside linear algebra. So for example, one way to create a subspace is to get rid of those starting points. If you have you have a span of a set of vectors, a set of all possible linear combination, it's always going to be a subspace. And so one way of making subspaces is just to consider linear combinations of vectors with no offset, such as you take all the rows of a matrix and you consider all the vectors you can reach by taking linear combination of rows. You're going to get a subspace. Take the columns of a matrix. You take all possible linear combinations of columns, you generate a space. There's no constant yet, so you won't have any offset there, and you'll again get a subspace. So at first, subspaces are going to look very common. Then I show you that they're actually pretty rare. But now what I'll show you on Monday is that the usual subspaces are also very common and easy to work with. Okay, so I'll stop here today and wish you a happy weekend. Do have a look at the material. And so any questions I can address on material that's going to be covered on the first exam, I'll be happy to talk about at length on Monday. We will do a general review, a full review on Wednesday.